This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Antonio Villaraigosa, both the former mayor of Los Angeles and chair of the Democratic National Convention. I am Ruslan Ali, chief executive officer of the XQ Institute and a managing director at the Emerson Collective, and moderator for today's program. We are honored to be with Mayor Villaraigosa today. During his tenure of mayor, where he was served two terms from 2005 to 2013, he spearheaded policy efforts in crime reduction, education reform, sustainable economic growth, as well as working on infrastructure and transit modernization. He previously served on the LA City Council and as Speaker of the California State Assembly, and is a leading voice in California politics today. On the national political scene, Mayor Villaraigosa was co-chairman of Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential bid and chair of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. He is a fellow at Harvard University and a public policy professor at USC. Welcome, Mayor, to San Francisco.
Was a fellow at Harvard, but I am a professor of practice at SC and on the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Thank you. Thank you for that correction. Mr. Mayor, we're at a time when politics feels impossible to so many. Your storied and overwhelmingly successful tenure, though, as mayor, and your experience generally seems to exemplify a different way. Can you share with us some experiences that led you to believe that it is possible to do what's right, to move a city, to help people, not come out jaded and cynical?
You know, I met the two gentlemen right now, and he said I was looking you up and didn't realize you were 63 or something to that effect. And, you know, I'm 63, and I've been doing this since I was 15 years old. I started out with the farm worker boycott against grapes. I tell people that I didn't speak a lick of Spanish, never worked in the fields, but I knew I had a responsibility. I was a student leader and a community leader and labor leader, and then finally ran for the assembly in 1994, and have been in public service now for 20 years. And I tell people, I'm 63 and I still believe. I'm not jaded. I'm not cynical. But like you, I am concerned about the shrill nature of our politics. And I say that particularly on the right, for sure, where, you know, they've gone far to the right than, you know, anything we've seen, I think, in modern times. But, you know, it takes two to tango, and sometimes on the other side, there's a shrill nature to our discourse. That I think has turned off a whole lot of people. And, you know, I'm old-fashioned, but I think that, statesmanship and civility and respect for other ideas. I was president of the ACLU of Southern California prior to getting elected. And although I'm unabashedly a progressive, I tell people, I grew up in an environment where we respected the battle of ideas. And unfortunately, there's very little of that right now in our public discourse. And that's too bad, because I think we need more of that. That's why I've started a project just last week called Bridges Not Walls, where... And by the way, in 2007, when I went to Mexico to meet the new Mexican president, we had just voted for a wall, Democrats and Republicans, by the way, and I stood up and said, we don't need walls, we need bridges, we need to communicate, we need to work with one another, we need to reach across the border or the aisle or whatever other divide we have. And this issue for me is, it's, I think, the most important issue we could be working on. It's very clear the country's evenly divided, as much as we might not like it here in the Bay Area or in L.A., and figuring out how you could work with people that you disagree with, I think, is the big challenge. And certainly stopping people who really don't represent our values as human beings or our values as a nation, people like Mr. Trump, I think has to be the first order of our business right now. You know, when you argue that we ought to close down mosques and bar Muslims from entering our country, when you say that a judge, whether he or she is Muslim or of Mexican descent, can't opine on a fraud case, we're taking, when you see the kind of violence, by the way, on both sides, we have to be concerned about what walls represent. And so I might be old-fashioned, but I'm for bridges. And I think more people are for bridges than we see in our body politic today.
And what is the way forward, given how divisive and cynical our civic conversation is today, how disenfranchised so many voters across all demographics feel in the process?
Well, it's the $24 million question or whatever that
I think it's like 64.
$64 million question. You know, those colloquialisms sometimes escape me. it's a $64 million question. I think you have to model it.
Yeah.
I started out as the Democratic firebrand. Probably didn't follow it, but I was Willie Lewis Brown Jr.'s majority whip 3 weeks into my time as an assembly member. I was majority leader 2 years later because I was fairly good at, you know, demonizing the other side and personalizing my politics. And then I became speaker and I realized, you know, they got elected too and people elect you to get things done. And so I put Democrats and Republicans together and both parties went into a caucus and took umbrage with having to sit with one another. And my response was, Willie, like, what about being speaker? Do you not understand? I got elected and I get to organize the rules of the House and we're going to sit together because maybe we'll figure out we all got screamed at our town hall, threw a wild pitch at a little league game and have a little tension at home because we're not home enough. So I gave Republicans proportionality of resources. I gave them the ability to name every vice chair. And for 2 years, I got a budget more or less on time during that era was tough to do. So I think you got to model it. I think we got to lower our voices. I think we got to stand for our principles, but recognize that you got to work with people that don't agree with you. And we get elected to get things done, so you focus on progress.
Your leadership by both designation and influence and as speaker and throughout your career has been one of an unyielding commitment to your values and positions while at the same time not alienating those that were in opposition to your policies. Is it finding the personal, the human, the goodness in your opposition, or is it more strategic than that?
Well, there's some strategy to it. I mean, you know, you do get elected to get things done, so, you know, at least that's what I think we're supposed to get elected for. I mean, you get elected to get things done, so, yeah, there's some strategy to it, but it's, you know, I left, and I remember, and if you remember my speakership toughest assault weapons ban in the country, became the model for the nation. You know, largest expansion of health care since Medi-Cal. I was the author. The first anti-discrimination bill against gays, the LGBT community. I mean, under my speakership, a lot of the most progressive legislation occurred. And yet, I was never afraid to cut a deal with people I didn't agree with. So I did Healthy Families, 750,000 people had health care. I started out with single payer, couldn't get a vote. I did Healthy Families with Pete Wilson, who I fought on 187 and 209, the anti-affirmative action. So, you know, yes, was there some strategy? The strategy was, you know, we've got to get things done. But also, you know, I remember upsetting some people when I left, and I said I learned a lot. I started out as a Democratic firebrand and still a fighter for what I believe in, but I learned that there are Democrats I vote with every day who I wouldn't invite to my home for dinner. And there are Republicans who I never vote with who I would. I learned that people are people and people are good, mostly. And I like working with good people, so it was a little of both. I could fight from time to time as well, but I particularly once I became Speaker and Mayor, I think I realized I had a bigger job than that. And, you know, this bridges, not walls, is about making the case that we need uniters, not dividers, and that whatever your politics, ultimately our job is to bring people together and find common ground, even with people that you don't mostly agree with.
Now, speaking of big and bigger jobs, there
must be somebody's question there.
We do have several audience questions, one of which I know is on the mind of not just lots of folks in the room, but lots of folks around the state and country, and that is, will you run for governor?
You know, I was already going to take that. I was already picking it up. That's an easy answer. I think it's pretty clear where this is going. You know, I'm not making any announcements today, but I think people are pretty clear. And I said recently, I got a lot of service left in me. I loved being mayor of a city my grandpa came to 100 years ago, a city that gave me a shot and let me try my hand at it. I loved being speaker, and I was honored to have done that as well. And I'm looking, but right now I'm focused on, I think there's no more dangerous threat to our democracy than the candidacy of this man running as the Republican nominee. And I do not speak as a Democrat. I speak as an American who loves my country. And so I'm going to focus on that for now. And then right afterwards, you're probably going to hear from me. But not till then. And I think it's just the most important thing we could be working on right now.
A question from the audience related to this issue of people being involved in this process, being involved in the civic and political conversation. An audience member wants to know, what do you feel can be done to encourage more people to participate in the electoral process?
You know, in anticipation of this, I was doing some reading, and, you know, as you know, we're made it easier to register to vote, and we have one of the best laws in the country now to do that. What other examples of, you know, states that have done things like this have shown, there'll be a bump, but not as big a bump in voter participation. And what some of the experts and the big thinkers around this issue are looking at are things like a lot more in the way of civic education. I think both parties do as much as they can to get out their vote and then forget, particularly the occasional and low voter turnout demographic. We know that the people that vote the least are younger, poorer, and less educated, and we're not focused enough on including them. And so this effort will be focused on that demographic, because it is not healthy for our democracy to have so few people voting. And our public policy oftentimes, the priorities don't reflect the needs when such a vast swath of our community aren't participating. I'm a big believer that it's not just about voting. If you read the book Bowling Alone and books like that that talk about participation, it's also very importantly participating, you know, in unions, in your church, in your synagogue, and, you know, in civic life. Encouraging civic participation is essential, and I think very, very important. So it's a whole lot of things. Certainly taking on these voter ID laws around the nation. We don't have that problem here, but we do have the problem. I mean, California's voting, until 1990, California was leading in terms of voter participation. Today, we lag significantly behind. And so we have to make investments in voter education and civics and other mechanisms. You know, Colorado's looking at some things that I think we need to be looking at, and other states are as well. Oregon.
The question from the audience: has Donald Trump's presidential race fostered racism, or simply brought existing racism to the surface?
I'm not a sociologist or an anthropologist, but I will say this. There's no question that he's stoking a fire. I think it would be simplistic to deduce it just to racism and misogyny and, you know, religious discrimination and the like. He's feeding on a frustration that people are feeling, white working class, but also on the, you know, on both sides. I mean, it's not just on his side. People are feeling like the economy's not working for them, and it's not. You know, if I told you, bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, we've always seen this country, and it's certainly been true for many of us looking at the demographic here. You know, this is a country, we've always believed that you could start at the bottom and go to the top in a way like no other place in the world. And when you leave here, Google the OECD Equality of Opportunity Index, and we're 16th today and going in the wrong direction. I'm not talking about income inequality. I'm talking about equality of opportunity. There is no question that not since the time of the robber barons have we had this kind of gap. My grandpa came from Mexico 100 years ago, and I tell people he came from a country of rich and poor. And I live in a country that's increasingly rich and poor. So figuring out how we address that frustration in a creative and innovative way, in a way that addresses and the root causes and find solutions is important, because otherwise the phenomena of Trump is the phenomena of Le Pen, is the phenomena that you see occurring in Germany, in Austria, in some of the Scandinavian countries. It is in England. It's a phenomenon. Demagoguery feeds on the frustration of people. Simple solutions are what people are looking for when there are none. Mm-hmm. So it, yes, it's, he's feeding and fomenting a racial animus that we all have to take umbrage with. By the way, I'd say this in an all, you know, I know this is the Bay Area and it's probably a little more, an audience a little more receptive, but you'll see me say this everywhere. Because, you know, I do not believe that that kind of, you know, divisiveness has a place in our body politic. But it would be too simplistic to deduce it just to that. Mm-hmm. It's a bigger issue, and it's one that we're going to have to deal with. You know, with, you know, he and Sanders talk about, you know, trade. It's actually, most of the experts will tell you it's not really trade. It's globalization. And globalization is unstoppable. 8 out of 10 new markets are outside of the country. We have to trade. We have to figure that out. But we also have to figure out how we, you know, put people in good jobs. The shared economy, this is the epicenter of it. You know, I tell people, we can be for a shared economy, but let's share and let's invest. So it's globalization, but also technology. So with technology, we're going to have driverless cars. Do you know how many people work for a living driving cars and buses and taxis and Ubers and Lyfts? And we're going to have to figure that out. Driverless cars will be here. So we have to train and invest and make sure that people have something else. I think addressing and confronting those issues is what we should be doing instead of, you know, stoking the fire and feeding on them in a way that is so simplistic and is frankly just won't work. So yes, he's feeding and fomenting. Yes, it exists without his doing, but it's also bigger than that.
And it sounds like it's, I hear you saying it's fear-based. He's
fear-based.
Playing on the fears. At the same time, as you commented about a lack of involvement of young people, particularly in the electoral process.
Well, not just young people. Poor people, undereducated people, yes. I mean, well, when in the last mayoral election, I think it was an 18% turnout in LA, and I was in the affluent areas of the city, still mayor, and some people said something to the effect, well, those people don't vote. And I said, ma'am, excuse me, the Palisades didn't vote. I mean, nobody, when you're at 18%, nobody voted, you know? I mean, like, let's be honest, most of us didn't vote. So, but who are the people that vote the least? The younger, the poor, the less educated. There, we've got to focus on. You know, at some point, you know, I'm hoping, you know, we address money in politics and this stranglehold that money has on, you know, our parties. I mean, I think a billion now is what we're going to raise on each side for the election. I mean, like, where did that come from? I mean, until 2012, we weren't anything close to that. So there are a lot of things we got to address, but certainly one of them.
You reference lack of
I forgot there was people back there, and I'm talking to you, so don't, you know, the problem with this kind of, you know, you got to look at the person talking to you, and then you realize you got a bunch of people over here. So
a bunch of people really interested in asking you a bunch of questions. That's what I have the great privilege of, sifting through these amazing questions and plethora of cards.
And then ask anything you want.
You mentioned in your last set of comments lack of education a couple of times. In Los Angeles, especially, certainly throughout your role in state government, but in Los Angeles, you were widely known for pushing past the traditional status quo when it comes to the state of education, especially in the Los Angeles Unified School District. Question from the audience thanks you for your leadership in helping low-income children in public schools in California and asks how you can bring education reform statewide given the power of the political dynamics and, as this question asks, specifically with the power of the CTA?
Well, first of all, I worked for the CTA, and I worked for the local teachers union, UTLA, and I worked for the NEA. I was married to a teacher for 20 years. I know how tough that profession is. I know that, you know, good percentage of them leave within the first 5 years. But when I became mayor, well, let me back up. If you Googled me, you'd know that I was a high school dropout, got kicked out of school before that. I went to UCLA on an affirmative action program, but I tell people it was a Catholic school that gave me a foundation, but a public school that gave me a second chance. I lived at a time when there was an affirmative action program that allowed me to go to a great university, UCLA, and some people would say I came in through the back door. But one thing's for sure, I got out the front. So I'm a big believer in investing in people. And when I became mayor of Los Angeles, we had a 44% graduation rate. And I said, that's just not good enough. And I wanted to work with everybody, particularly teachers union. And I said to them, let's work together. And I made it absolutely clear that although I support unions, I think I support them so much, I think parents ought to have one. And kids ought to have one, and if neither do, I will be their advocate. So that we balance our decision making. And, you know, by the time, you know, I tried to take over the school, when I take it over to participate, to partner with him, the legislature gave me the authority, a Democratic legislature gave me the authority. The school district sued. I lost at trial and on appeal based on the Constitution and the Charter. I then helped elect school board members because 7% of the population is voting for school board members. So guess, you know, who wins these elections? The people who...
It's 2.5 times the rate that voted in the mayor election.
Well, that was 19% mayoral. 7% voted for school board.
I'm saying 2.5 times.
The other way around, right. And so, you know, by the time I left, well, I took over 17 schools. I said, give me the lowest performing, most violent schools in Los Angeles. So I took on a good portion of the schools in Watts, the high school in Watts, 2 middle schools of Watts, 6 elementary schools. I took my alma mater on. My alma mater, when I went to Roosevelt High School, had a 75% dropout rate. When I became mayor, they'd improved. It was now 65%. So I took over my alma mater and a couple other schools. I took over a school with a 27% graduation rate. Today, that school has a 72% graduation rate. My schools still run them, 77% graduation rate. We started at 36, and the school district went from 44 to 72. And I said, that's still not good enough. Nothing to brag home to mother about, because every kid should be graduating from high school. The parents here, I mean, you know, we expect our kids all to graduate from high school. And I love hearing people say, not everybody needs to go to college, and that's true. But, you know, when certain communities disproportionately don't go, that's not true, and that's not good enough. We'll be 2 million down in the number of college graduates and people with specialized skills, you know this better than I, by 2025. That's 9 years from now. If we don't start educating these kids... When you heard me say it's the civil rights issue of our time, when you look at who's not graduating, who's not going, 13% kids of color, Latino and African American going to 4-year colleges, 13%. I think when I started it was 10. You know, if we don't do something about this, this is connected. This is a civil rights issue of our time, the economic issue of our time, because the new economy is all about, you know, intellectual capital. Not so long ago, I gave a speech here in San Francisco for Ed at the Conference of Mayors, which I used to be president of, and I gave a speech, and papers said, well, three of these people who may be running for something later on, two of them spoke about the new economy, and Villaraigosa spoke about the civil rights implications of education. Said, well, they're about the future, and he's about the past. So every time I come to this area, I said, let me start with a new economy. We won't have one if we don't start educating people. It's not going to work. So economic issue of our time, I already said it's the democracy issue of our time. How are people so easily influenced by demagogues when, you know, not reading the paper? And they get their news from, you know, very limited, you know, and oftentimes biased sites. And finally, you know, it's the national security issue of our time when people can't pass a test to get into the military, and the social divisiveness that we will see in this country, you know, it's connected that will come when so many people are locked out of our economy. So I tell people, what are we talking about across the country? Income inequality, quality of opportunity, Black Lives Matter, the prison industrial complex, the pipeline to prisons. It's all connected. You know, Kamala talks a lot about before you go to prison, you had a record of being a truant, you dropped out, you're not reading. It's all connected. So I spent a lot of time on this issue, and we asked me about the future, and what am I going to be spending my time on? I'm going to talk about this issue. Because if we want to be the golden, restore the luster to the golden state, we got to include more people in that pot at the end of the rainbow, that golden pot at the end of the rainbow, and that comes with education. When people ask me how I broke so many glass ceilings, and I broke more than just the mayor now, I tell people it's simple. I can read and write. We have got to make investments in people. Now, it's not just, it starts with universal preschool, mm-hmm. particularly for kids whose parents can't afford it. It goes through, you know, putting metrics by and rethinking. I know you're working on what 21st century education ought to be. And then it includes college affordability. It's got to be all of that. And then workforce training. There are jobs that we can do now, including in tech. You don't have to have an engineering degree from Stanford to be a coder. We should be focused on those things. It's linked learning. It's all of that. And you'll be hearing more in the future after we stop Trump.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, both the former mayor of Los Angeles and chair of the Democratic National Convention. I am Russ Linnelli, Chief Executive Officer of the XQ Institute and a Managing Director at the Emerson Collective. Formerly, I was Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights under Barack Obama and Secretary Arne Duncan. Commonwealth Club programs are on the radio, and you can see our program videos on our YouTube channel, as well as catch up with us on our website and Facebook and Twitter. Now, Mayor, I'm going to shift the question.
Let me just stop for a second, because, you know, Ruslan, when I saw that, I didn't see it till last night, that you were moderating this, I was very pleased. And, you know, we worked together, as you know, when you worked in Secretary Duncan's office, and your work is known around the country. Your work at Ed Trust is well known. You know, as someone who's unabashedly a progressive, unabashedly for all of the interests that are very powerful but have historically been associated with our schools, and yet, you know, believe strongly that poor people can learn, and these kids need a fighting chance, and the only way they're going to get it is if we invest in them. So it's good to be with you today.
Thank you.
That's my commercial. Since you did
thank
a commercial
you.
Announcement, I got to do one too. Got to do my
That's
own commercial.
Very adapter. Generous of you, Mr. Mayor. Now, the audience has a lot of questions in this massive stack I have here. No, it's growing ever massive. About public transit. Now, you were very involved in energizing LA's successful update to its public transit system. Today, you're here with us in San Francisco, the heart of American tech innovation. With all the controversy around high-speed rail and recent developments of infrastructure concepts like Hyperloop, what do you think the role of private sector innovators will be on improving our infrastructure? We have questions related, so I'm gonna hit you with all of them.
I would just say, add too many of them because I won't remember them all. But
okay, they're going to be on the high-speed rail.
Okay. High-speed rail, right? Hyperloop,
several
private sector.
Yes, high-speed rail, state support for high-speed rail, controversy of Hyperloop, and then we're going to get to the Sacramento Water Delta Project.
Okay, so we'll separate that
yes.
one. I mean, we'll answer it.
Yes.
Get there. You know, L.A. is the car capital of the United States, and I know you all here in the Bay Area love to say that you're strangled by traffic, and you are for maybe 5 hours out of the day. Try 14. That's the difference. It's not that the traffic's any worse. It's just it's all day and night. So when I said I'd do a subway to the sea and, you know, build our public transportation system in the car capital of the United States of America, everybody looked at me and said, he's nuts. And maybe I was. But I tell people, after one busway, three light rail lines, and two lines in construction that just opened since I left mayor, built more lines than any city in the country in that 8-year period of time, and more than any person before me in LA history, which wasn't that hard because we didn't have that much. But I tell people, this wasn't just about moving people and goods and addressing, you know, carbon emissions and traffic and gridlock, and it was really something different. So I said, it's about reimagining the city. I said, you go to San Francisco, and I mentioned y'all all the time. You go to New York, you go to Paris, you go to London, and people live vertically. And it can be good. And I said, this is about reimagining this city. By the way, in a town that's known historically as anti-development, I convinced Angelinos that we needed to rethink, leverage our investment for affordable housing and smart growth along transportation lines. You look at downtown today, a lot different. See a few heads raised. You look at Hollywood, the same. So it was about reimagining the city. It was about smart growth. It was about moving people and traffic and, you know, jobs and infrastructure jobs, which, you know, very critical. But it was also about innovative financing. So you said P3s or private sector. I also challenged this notion. I said, in a world where even the Democrats won't raise the gas tax, where there's not enough money at the federal or state level to make these investments, we ought to think about innovative financing. So I chaired with Secretary LaHood, former Secretary of Transportation, the Miller Center effort on middle-class jobs in the infrastructure. I sit on the Bipartisan Policy Center Infrastructure Committee. We just put out a report. I speak around the world on this issue. And I tell people, cities and counties and states and federal government aren't going to be able to do it all. So around the world, you see the private sector participating too. I mean, we shouldn't be afraid of that. Got to make sure we get our money's worth. We got to make sure that, you know, they get return on their money, but that return isn't, you know, too heavy on the public purse. But ultimately, we got to do all of that. So, high-speed rail, I'm for it. And I know it's not popular, but I'm for it because there are 16 countries in the world that have high-speed rail. I mean, at what point are we going to get into the 21st century? Now, I also said we got to value engineer it, and we got to leverage it like we did. What people are loving about what we're doing public transit-wise in L.A. is that we're reimagining the city, and that's what we got to do with high-speed rail. We got to reimagine this state, create economic development, use that as an economic development driver, which creates dividends well beyond the ridership. Make investments. Hyperloop, I called Elon as soon as he came up with the idea. It sounded, you know, far out to me, but I welcome the far out. When I started campaigning on doing all this transit in LA, everybody thought I was nuts. This guy, you know, I didn't get invited to any of these openings because, you know, once you're out, you know, and nobody invites you, nobody remembers you, and they forget who did all this stuff. But, you know, that's fine. So this one guy seeks me out.
And you have quite the audience here today, Mr. Mayor.
It's funny. This one guy seeks me out, and he's calling my assistant just incessantly. I said, tell her to talk to the mayor or talk to somebody else. I don't want to do anything on this. And she says, he's got to talk with you. He's got to talk with you. He says he really's got to apologize and he wants to talk to us. So we go to the exposition line as it opened the other day. And he says, you know, I just feel like I got to publicly apologize. I said, why? He says, when you campaigned in 2001 and then in 2005 and you put it on the ballot and your America Fast Forward and all, he said, I thought you were nuts. And I said it every single day on my radio show. And I said, if he ever builds that subway to Santa Monica, I swear I'll eat my whatever he was going to eat. And I never know those colloquial. I guess it's your hat, right? So, you know, he wanted to say he was sorry. And I said, why are you going to say you're sorry? I mean, everybody thought I was nuts. So I think Hyperloop, I mean, it's a technology that is, you know, obviously into the future. But I think we got to be investing in technology and rethinking everything. We got to include the private sector. We got the state. I'm trying to remember all your questions. The role of the state, you know, the next leader of this state has got to do what we got the federal government to do, and that is in a world of deficits and debt, we got to have innovative financing, and that means bonds and loan programs that operate as an infrastructure bank to rebuild our bridges, our highways, and support investments like high-speed rail. And I know a guy who did that.
How does that guy convince all the other guys?
I'm having fun.
And how does that guy convince all the other guys?
Well, and women. You know, I think it's always hard.
I want to stop right there because, right, I love that he corrected me and said, hey, and women.
You know, well, you know, I think you do it. Look, it's always rough. I don't know if you remember, you wouldn't because you all live in San Francisco. I said we were going to make LA the cleanest, greenest big city in America, and I remember people kind of, you know, going like this. In fact, and, you know, I signed on to Kyoto. There were about 100 mayors that had signed on, including Mayor of San Francisco at the time. And Kyoto says you have to reduce carbon emissions by 7% of 1990 levels by 2012. By 2012, we did 28%, number one American city, number five in the world. And I said, well, and I also said, you'll almost never see that written in the newspaper of record. Now, what they do remember is I said we'd plant 1 million trees. And guess how many we did? 400,000. Guess how many that was? Not 1 million. I got reminded of that every single day. But wait, it was 6 times more than we ever did. U.S. Forestry called it the number one urban forestry program in the country, and the California Forestry Service called it the number one in California. I say that to say this. I think leaders have to be dreamers, and I think they have to swing for the fences. And that means sometimes they'll make fun of you and ridicule you, but we don't get elected to take up space. We get elected to do things. And so I think this state has got to do things big again. And so Hyperloop, you know, high-speed rail. And by the way, I'll say that in the most conservative audiences and get people booing at me and tell me what an ignoramus I am. And, you know, I don't buy the idea that these are jobs for the timid and for the people who, you know, I mean, if you ever played ball, you know, I mean, when you go up to bat, you're thinking home run every time you get up there. Tell the truth. Anybody's ever played baseball or football, you get that ball and you want a touchdown and you want to score a 69-yard touchdown. I mean, you know, who goes up to bat to just to, you know, want to get on base? You know, obviously, you want to get on base and you want to get a run in. But, you know, I think we got to think big again. And that's what we try to do with education and climate change. And, you know, I don't know if you know, took over as mayor, one of the most violent cities in America. You Google it. Homicides down 50%, violent crime down 50%, homicides down 45% with constitutional community policing. You know, we were focused on keeping people safe, but also, you know, believed that there's something called the Constitution. We ought to respect people's civil liberties. And I just think you could do these things with great difficulty, and people, not everybody will be for it. And you're usually, the bolder you are, the more people are oppositional, and some of the things you want to do won't get completely done. And, you know, but it's kind of what happens when you're making sausage, right? It's not pretty.
Last infrastructure question, water. The drought.
I'm drinking it. And once again, I didn't get the tough question and start drinking water. It just happened that I was drinking water. Let me say this. I was on the Chris Hayes, MSNBC. They did a water wars. This might not be popular in this part of the state, by the way, what I'm going to say. But I'm going to say it anyway. I said, Chris, why do you call it water wars? And he says, Mayor, you went to 2 days watering a week. You reduced your water consumption by 23%. The largest decrease in water usage of cities over 1 million. He said, you got killed politically. The, you know, people thought they had a right to their swimming pools and their big lawns. And finally, you got pressured by the city council and, you know, threat of, you know, an initiative to 3 days watering a week. And he said, and your city and cities in the state are 80% of the population, and you use 20% of the water, and ag is 20% of the population and use 80% of the water. I said, you know, I'm not really good at math, but we drink 20% of the water. They use 80%. We eat all their almonds and onions and lettuce and tomatoes. So we eaten all their food. So we're eating and drinking 100% of the water. So I said, instead of pointing fingers, we had to reach out and work together. So what do I think about water? I think we all got to conserve it. I think we got to recycle. And by recycle, we doubled our recycling in LA. You know what that went from? From 1 to 3%. Or 2 to 4%. I know it was double. Really? You know, we could recycle a lot more. I think Orange County is at 30% or something. Big number. Big number. I think it's something close to that. You know, we should be, before we're pointing fingers, we need to recycle and reuse. And we did a lot of that, but we need to do a lot more. We need to clean up our underwater aquifers because groundwater storage is the best way to address some of these issues. We need to look at technology and how we drive down and make it easier to do all of these things. And, you know, so invest in universities that, you know, look to Israel, and I've been there twice, and including on a water mission. You know, I tell people, if we want to fix this problem, everybody's going to have to give to the piggy bank. I say that to Republican conservative farmers, and I say that to environmentalists too. Because when I went from 3% renewables to 20%, you know who blocked me? Who do you think? My friends in the environmental community stopped me from building solar in the desert, or at least try to stop me, stop me from building windmills, you know, in areas because I was killing birds. And I said, hold it, everybody. Climate change can't be the number one challenge that we're facing, and you give me, you know, every reason why we can't do some of this. So I think we need leadership that brings people together and gets them talking to one another. I think we all got to understand that we're not only in a, this is a permanent drought, and water is a precious commodity that we're going to have to conserve and treat well. I think all of us are going to have to give to the bank. We're obviously going to have to deal with conveyance and infrastructure. But before we build, you know, $30 and $40 billion worth of infrastructure, there are smart things like cleaning up our aquifers that we could do. I do believe in all of the above, and I have friends that don't agree with that. But you know, when you take 12 years, and I know the power footprint, and I know that you know what diesel is not anybody's first option. But when you look at Israel and you saw what they've done, you got to say, in a desert, we're going to have to look at everything again. Start with conservation. Start with recycling. And by the way, not just urban areas, but agricultural areas as well. And then, you know, flexibility. You know, we started off with, you know, our public discourse today. I tell people, you know, I'm not a kid on a college campus anymore. You know, I'm still a progressive, but I'm not an ideologue. And ultimately, we get elected to get things done and to balance interest. And when one alternative is nothing in terms of progress, I think another alternative is kind of moving it forward. So I like sitting down with people that don't agree with me and scream at me, and then sitting down with my friends and pushing them a little bit and, you know, building grand bargains. They're often difficult, by the way, and you gotta roll up your sleeve and upset everybody, but, you know, get a little progress from time to time. So I think the water issue is an issue that we can address without question, but it's going to be painful for all of us, and we're going to have to rethink how we do things. So technology, conservation, recycling, you know, spread the pain and the splendor, or the benefits.
We're going to segue entirely. Audience question on professional sports teams, right? I think we need to do a shout out for Go Warriors, right?
So before we get there, let me just say this. So I'm on the Brian Copeland show the other day for Hillary. And first thing he says, you know, Mayor of L.A., will you say go Giants for me? I said, that's easy. Go Giants. I said, and then I laughed and I said, look, I'm a Laker fan. You know, when the Lakers play the Warriors, just like when UCLA played SC, I'm a Bruin. I was for UCLA. But once I became mayor, I was for SC against the world. Now that I'm looking north, I'm for the Warriors against the Cavs. Go Warriors. I'm for the Giants, you know. But, you know, we all come from our little regions, and, you know, I got my little guys over there. So, and like I said, with the Warriors doing as well as they're doing and the Lakers and the Clippers not, you know, I guess I'm going to be for the Warriors a lot more than I am for the hometown team.
Okay. How do you see these organizations, sports teams, as contributing to and or detracting from, the audience member asked, the civic identities and local economies? You've had quite an experience in Los Angeles.
I think they contribute greatly to the esprit de corps of a city, a state, a country. You know, I mean, you know, when that our women's soccer team was, you know, in the World Cup, and we, even if you don't play soccer, don't know anything about it, you get excited and you root for the home team. And, you know, I think they're mostly, you know, great for our esprit de corps, our, you know, kind of coming together as a city, state, region, a country. You know, I think there are some things that, you know, you look at the salaries these people make, and no disparaging any of them, but things seem sometimes a little out of whack. But I think mostly it's good and positive. And, you know, when you're running for office, you know, not to be knocking on somebody's door when there's a championship game, you know, or calling them. So, you know, I think it's mostly positive. Yeah. You know. I would say I do think we need to address the fact that, you know, we get so excited about guys playing tennis and, you know, basketball and all these other sports. And, yeah, watching women do the same thing, it, you know, can be and should be as exciting. And I know that there are issues there and certainly issues that we should address.
Thank
I like you. Watching my kids play. Well, they're not kids anymore. I have a, let's see, 23, 28, 27, 38, and 41-year-old, a grandchild who's 21, a grandchild who's 10, and a great-grandchild who's 2. So I have little ones, but they're grandkids and great-grandkids, and then I now have a 25-year-old and a 15-year-old who'll be part of my family and my children when I get married in 2 months. So,
well, congratulations. Audience question that takes us to the primaries.
Primaries?
Yes.
Drinking water again, just.
We know as of a few moments ago that Secretary Clinton is the Democratic nominee. The audience member asks, do you think she is a uniter or a divider?
A uniter. Ugh. Is a uniter? I mean, you know, look, we could all have our perspectives. I've known her for 20 years. She's unquestionably a uniter. I think it's going to be tough to be in this race and, you know, with somebody like Trump. I think she was strongest the other day when she used his own words to criticize him. When you use too many adjectives, you know, the press are going to make it look like you're both going into a knife fight. And I think she'll be successful because she'll speak to a national unity in. And getting back to the civic discourse that we talked about earlier, I think she demonstrated, and I know a lot of people in my party don't agree with me, but she demonstrated, I mean, you know, in a country that's this evenly divided, you need people that can talk to people that you don't agree with. I mean, we have to do it in our families, don't we? We're all sitting there at the dinner table and, you know, my brother loves, you know, to play this Trump card with me and, you know, wants to agitate me and get me excited. And, you know, I had my brother. So I try to figure out how to talk to him and love him. And, you know, he likes to play around with me. I know he's not for him, but he just loves to needle me. And I think we got to be able to figure out where the common ground is. And I know it's not easy. And it'll be easier in the state, but even here, I read, I think it was a PPIC, another PPIC paper on, you know, how partisan we are. Even though this is a blue state, the divide is actually greater than, you know, some of the swing states like Colorado and even Arizona. The divide in terms of the policy divide. So figuring out how we kind of, in a world where you need two-thirds for important stuff, not the budget anymore, but you need two-thirds, figuring out how you get people there is a challenge. She's a uniter, without question.
We've reached the point in our program where there is only time for one last question.
Well, I only have 1 minute, so I'll have to make it a short answer, right?
Mr. Mayor, I have found this time with you enlightening and inspiring. What inspires you for the big ideas and big changes that we as a state need to embark on together? What does the journey look like?
Well, what inspires me are people. I didn't want to get stuck in that green room, and I kind of calm my nerves by, you know, kind of making contact with people. But I think what I'm inspired by is this belief in people. I think most people are good. I grew up in a family that believed that. And I think we're on this planet to do good. And I get inspired by people. And so in the course of the next couple of years, I think you'll see me around a lot of them. And you will, because I find that I'm better when I'm listening to a broad cross-section of people and most useful in that regard.
Wow. Thank you. Our thanks to Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles. I am Ruslan Ali, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.